No matter what anyone tells you, words and ideas can change the world. I was 15 when I heard the words of John Keating, and yet it took me 5 years to act on them. I still was, and well, I'm not gonna lie, I still am extremely worried about making an impact on the world, to be gone without leaving an identity, and to die not knowing who I am, not knowing who I could be. The idea of identity, of not knowing who we are, what we stand for, has been an internal struggle for many. For some of us, our identities are restricted to the work we do. For some, it's our families. For some, it might be friends or the position in society. And I thought of kickstarting 2024 with the debate of identity in academia itself. Don't worry, my dear listeners, this is still a science communication podcast, but recognizing and talking openly about the issues of suppression in academia is essential to practicize knowledge, to seek truth, and to bring more impact in research. Today's guest, as I put to him, is a devilishly handsome, multifaceted professional with a deep commitment to mental health, education, and advocacy within diverse communities. As a psychotherapist, clinical supervisor, and lecturer at University of Toronto's Mark S. Bonham Centre for Sexual Diversity Studies, I have the privilege of inviting Rahim Thawar here with me. Rahim's expertise extends across various domains, from facilitating discussions on innovative approaches to queer relationships to advocating for harm reduction, sex positivity, anti-oppression, and trauma-informed practices. A true advocate for inclusivity and understanding, Rahim has dedicated nearly a decade to community organizing with Salaam Canada, a national LGBTQ Muslim organization. His contributions to the local LGBTQ history anthology, Any Other Way, How Toronto Got Queer, as a co-editor and essayist, showcased his commitment to persevering and sharing narratives that shape our understanding of diverse experiences. Currently, Rahim is channeling his passion for storytelling and insights into his upcoming book, Seeking Stories from a Gay Therapist Making Sense of Connection and Relationships, slated for publication by Thorntree Press. Through his work, Rahim continues to explore the intricacies of human connection, relationships, offering invaluable perspectives drawn from his experiences as a gay therapist. Hi, Rahim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So good to see you and so good to have you here. I think this is like the first time that my podcast is discussing something related to gender identity and LGBTQA+. And to have somebody like you, it's seriously an honor. So thank you so much for coming and talking about this for our Indian community. I have already introduced you to the listeners, but you know, maybe in 2 to 3 minutes, just talk about how you got into queer activism, what joys does your work bring, and you know, everyday stuff that you want the listeners to know. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, I am 38 years old. I am a social worker and a psychotherapist.
You're 38?
Yeah.
You don't look 38 at all. Oh my God.
Yeah, well, I'm 38. I did my master's of social work back in 2010-2011.
Right.
But I began doing queer activism during my undergraduate degree. Now, my undergraduate degree was 2004-2008. So quite a while ago. We're talking, you know, almost 20, like I began almost 20 years ago.
Right.
And I take us back to that time because my undergraduate degree and my time during undergrad was really, it was difficult, but also formative. Mm-hmm. You know, the first couple of years of my undergrad, it was so important for me to be, my first year was so important for me to be separate and away from all of my Muslim community.
Right.
I just wanted so much space from them. I was like, I want to figure out who I am outside of this community. Mm-hmm. I want to explore my sexuality maybe, or even just come to terms with it.
Yeah.
There was such a familiarity with fellow Muslims, but also like a kind of suffocation. When you know everybody, it doesn't always give you a space to think independently, you know, like good people, but like
Yeah, I know.
sociologically, you can't think independently when you're around people who there's just so much presumed sameness. You get stuck in that. And at that time, I was one of my struggles from a mental health perspective was like thinking, oh, am I atheist? And I was thinking about atheism. My entry point to questioning all of religion was sexuality. And I know that's not the same for everybody, but for me, I was thinking like, well, what if Allah doesn't accept me? What if my community doesn't accept me? What if who I am is a sin? What if I don't go to heaven? What if all my good deeds are discounted by this sin? All of this kind of stuff. And now when I look back, I'm like, oh, it feels trivial, really, because I just don't care. But at the time, it felt huge. It felt huge. So when I was 21, it was 2007, I came out to my parents. Before that, right away in first year, I came out to my brother. I just needed a bit of physical distance to be able to do it. And my brother was supportive. And this felt good because he said we were at different universities at the time, and he went to the LGBT group on campus to get information. And so I was like, A, that's impressive. But B, it's so important that college and university campuses have this kind of resource, right? Because we're talking about the mental health and well-being of communities. It's like that's how you learn how to get support for yourself and how to support other people. And I really think the university experience, particularly in cultures where it's normal or encouraged even to move away from home, which it certainly is in North America, that these things be embedded in those campus institutions, right? So I came out to my family right before my final year. And then in my final year, I really got quite involved in the LGBT community. I started going to discussion groups. They were on every Wednesday night. And I started doing outreach work at a local HIV organization, which meant like going to the bar on the weekend and when they had drag shows and handing out condoms, lube, having conversations with people about safer sex, all this kind of stuff. So like my like introduction into safer spaces and community was already a kind of queer activism. And my first job after my undergraduate degree was at the Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention in Toronto. It's quite a unique organization, and it was so lovely to be with my people, you know, like to be with brown people and to talk about how our communities struggle, but also how our like they're silent about things, they don't talk about some things, they overemphasize other things, blah blah blah, but then also some of the good things, you know, like how do they hold us, how do they you know, can they love us unconditionally? How can they, the values of family over individual mean that, you know, maybe we're less likely to be kicked out, you know, things like that. So it's not a perfect community, of course, but to be able to process that is nice.
And you don't look like at all 38. Just let me tell the listeners that I'm looking at him and he doesn't look 38 at all. But that's such a cool life that you've led till now, and the kind of activism that you've done. I mean, obviously I'll link it in the description, the articles that you've written, the talks that
Sure.
you've given. But I want to talk about a little bit about my country in India, right?
Tell
Because
me.
my nation is extremely diverse. Like I told
Yes.
you, like it snows where I live, and you had absolutely no idea that a place like India has snow. But
Yes.
it's also a very conservative space, which is very shocking because we are a very diverse country, and talking about LGBTQA issues and mental health is still frowned upon in our country.
Yeah.
So, my friends wanted me to ask you this, and it's been like in my mind also for a really long time. So in such a space like our nation, how can we talk about sexuality? First of all, a person who doesn't feel good about their sexuality, how do they come up having open discussions about it? Certain tips or, you know, certain sort of insights that you have on this?
Sure. Well, first, I think we have to recognize that gender and sexual diversity is normal and natural and occurs everywhere, right? So if we haven't had a space to talk about it, it's because another way of being, or like maybe people would use the word ideology, has been prevalent. And when something is prevalent, a way of talking, a way of thinking, and it's upheld by a dominant culture, that means, whether we do it intentionally or not, another community is suppressed. Another narrative, dialogue, way of being is minoritized. So, and when we begin to have conversations, one of the biggest pushbacks can be, oh, this is, you know, a Western thing. And I think we need to really take a step back, right? We can't have such a myopic view of history. We can't, it's like we're willing to have conversations about colonization when it threatens like patriarchy or like heteronormative world. We're like, oh no, this is a Western way. This is imperialism. Just stop it. Like the, you know, it's these precise things that we hold on to that give men and heterosexual people quite a bit of power in our culture, colonial structures, right? So India, Pakistan, before colonialism, would likely have much more gender and sexual diversity.
Yeah.
It might not be talked about in the same way. I'm not saying people who were gender diverse or sexual minorities were having a great time pre-colonization, right? I'm not going to say like everything was amazing, but there was probably more nuance, more space for difference. There was more fluidity in the way we defined things. So my point here is that an entry point to conversation can be an exploration of one's own cultural history with regard to sexual and gender diversity.
Right.
I'll give a quick example. A number of years ago, when I was visiting India, I visited my family in Bhuj, which is a small community in Gujarat, not far from the border of Pakistan, maybe a few hour drive. And right before I was in Bhuj, I was in Bangalore, and I had I bought a book while I was in Bangalore. It was about the Hijra community. And my cousin, who's from Bhuj, he looked at the book and he said, Hikoroi, meaning, what is this? And I was like, oh, it's a book about gender. And he looked at it, and the way he said it was, oh, himaru je bhai maru nain ka bhai bi nain, meaning like somebody who's not a man or not a woman. And I was like, there in his description, in his question, he already has an idea of like a third gender.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And I was like, that is cool. That didn't come from the West. Right? Yeah. That is like, that's that came from somewhere else. You know, so I appreciated that, you know, because I was like, oh, okay, like. And it was like, yeah, that's exactly it. And then this book is, I mean, I hadn't read it at the time, but I was like, it talks a bit about how people are valued,
right,
and also how people are marginalized, and they're poor and can't get jobs. And then they're seen as evil or associated with, I don't know, some kind of witchcraft or something. I forget what it said specifically. But the point I made was like, we put them in these very small categories because there isn't a broader understanding of like where they could fit in society. And he was like, oh yeah, that's true. Okay, pass, cello. Then it was done. You know, I didn't want to have a bigger conversation. I didn't come out to him. All of this, like I wasn't there. My point is that when we're having conversations, A, I think we need to start with the assumption that our culture has some kind of knowledge and space for gender and sexual diversity. We have a history. We have to just learn about it, and we have to figure out where we fit in that history, you know? And so to me, that feels helpful. And then, of course, one other key thing is, you know, there's a difference between like a theoretical discussion and a support space, right? If you're in dire need of support and you're, you know, somebody from the LGBTQIA community, you know, maybe having a conversation with a miscellaneous straight person is not a good idea because they're not going to be able to provide you what you need. Maybe, but if it's a confidant, somebody you trust, or somebody else from the community, it might feel like an emotionally or psychologically safer conversation, right? So that's something to keep in mind.
So like you said, you know, like you didn't take the conversation far with your cousin, and that brings me to my next question, Rahim. So it's a question that, you know, I really wanted to ask you when I first met you. You know, it was like, maybe I should ask. No, let's save it for the podcast. Leave it. So I told you how people confuse gender versus sex here specifically in India. And it's a debate that's been going on since I don't remember when. I mean, you see videos on YouTube, people bringing in their own opinions. And it's a topic that spurs debates in, I think, in West a lot, even in India. And there have been riots. There have been, you know, human rights violations, literally. So in the 21st century, I actually believe that everybody has an idea of who they are. They should have an idea of who they are. And even if they don't, they should be able to express it, or they should be able to learn openly who they are, and they should have resources and everything. A lot of debate also comes when people talk about pronouns. Gen Z has taken it very seriously, let me tell you that. And the thing is that this is a very funny anecdote. This happened in a
Yes, tell
college
me.
recently. So what happened was our director, you know, no, sorry, I'm not a director. I think he was like the student's dean. Yeah, he messed up somebody's pronouns in the mail, right? And somebody's surname and the pronouns itself. And there was spam of emails like questioning. Like, he's a person who's an authority. Maybe he was busy in his work. So people just started questioning him. People are just like, we'll bash in his office. We'll do something to him. I don't know. This is not. And he got like, there was within minutes, there was a mail saying that I sincerely apologize. I mean, the authorities have never responded if, you know, there was a question paper change or there was dates shifted. We would get to know from somewhere else. But to this date, I still remember that sir responded with like the utmost speed to that. So people do go wild. I mean, this happens both ways. I mean, you would know that. If a person genuinely does not know what the other person identifies as, and they mess up their pronouns, what happens then is my question, right?
It's
And
a
how can we see that as a platform to openly discuss about what gender is rather than accuse one another? Because that has been a problem since like a long time now, and social media
Yes.
only spurred it even more.
Yeah, I can appreciate this. Okay. So let's start with gender versus sex, right? So I was taught that sex is about anatomy. It's what you're assigned at birth. And based on that anatomy, people around you treat you a certain way, socialize you. So they reward and punish certain behaviors. They dress you in certain ways. They have expectations of you based on something called gender, which is about a role that people expect you to play. It's something people expect you to perform throughout your life. And so you get rewarded and punished in the most extreme and also the most subtlest of ways by society and your family and your community to ensure that you stay within the parameters of a prescribed gender role. Now, I think this is why people find gender very limiting. And people who are cisgender, so people who don't question their gender identity, people who are not trans or not non-binary, they would also find it quite restricting. But it might not feel necessarily oppressive to them. So I think the separation of gender and sex, it might be more prevalent in Western culture. And there might be more of an overlap in other cultures, right? I don't know how people conceptualize it everywhere, but gender and sex weren't naturally separated here in North America or in Canada either. I had to learn it later, because we later in life we learn about things that we thought were normal, natural, and neutral. Right. So anytime I think about what I've been taught from a dominant lens, whether it's a white lens, a heterosexual lens, an able-bodied lens, an upper middle class lens, like whatever those values are or ways to be, they come with this idea that the way I'm teaching you to be is normal, natural, and neutral. It takes a long time before you say, oh, wait, that it doesn't have to be like that. But you don't even have the opportunity to question that, right? Unless it directly affects you. So I think I want to say from different cultures, the way I think about it is that gender and sex are going to be two separate things, but also they'll overlap. It might be a Venn diagram. And I would say the shape of that Venn diagram maybe changes based on place. Some people, like I was in South Africa a couple of years ago, I was there for a year, and people were telling me about a gendered rite of passage where a lot of men at a certain age are taken on a journey, and they're circumcised. And within the community, there's a number of people that said, this is like, that was an important journey. It was like how I learned to be a man and what it means to be a man. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but you'll have to explain it to me. And other people in the same room, in the same discussion space said, no, that experience was awful. Like I felt violated. The ways it taught me to be a man forever scarred me because that's not the kind of man I want to be. These were teachings of masculinity that have haunted me and they have deteriorated my mental health. So there could be one like cultural rite of passage ritual that works for somebody who fits the mold. But for somebody who has a different psychological experience and understanding of themselves, it's not going to fit, you know? So, like, even something like marriage, it could be amazing for somebody, and it can be horrible and awful for so many other people. Right. So, now I'll come to pronouns. I think we're in a place where we're talking about gender as being quite expansive. And I think one of the challenges with learning about anti-oppression theory and what it means to be part of a marginalized group. One of the challenges of it is that once you learn it, you can't unlearn it, and it can feel like a lot of ammunition. So when you feel or you experience even something small, like a microaggression, you might actually experience it in your body as such a violent form of structural oppression. And you respond in a very, very big way. And when we respond in a big way, it's like you might have heard of fight, flight, and freeze responses. That's something that happens in your nervous system when there's a significant threat in your environment. So we're going into fight mode, and we don't always need to, right? So it's a conversation actually with your nervous system to say, how big is this threat? And what is my objective, right? Do I want to create a learning space? Can I let somebody know with kindness why this isn't working? Or do I want to scare them, terrorize them? Do I want to respond from a place of fight? And I think Gen Z folks are coming in, like they're coming into these conversations at a very particular time. Like the climate is going to shit. Right. The most, and th those are the generations before them that have contributed to that. They're paying a lot of money for tuition and school. Jobs aren't guaranteed to them. The dream of emigrating to another place, like I'll get my degree and then go to like this other place, is like it's also squashed because they're like, no, those places are oppressive and white supremacist, like terrible places. If I just get an education, like my parents say, maybe I will then have a good paying job. Like, that's not true. Like, that's not,
It's
you
not true.
know? So they're coming into a world where, like, a lot of things that were fed and sold to us are not a reality now. And so they have a right to be angry about that. And so I think they're going to have to pick their battles, though, to decide what the new world looks like. I think when it comes to having conversations about sexuality and gender, and in particular, misgendering, I think we need to have more two-way conversations. So in my course outline, I teach at the University of Toronto as a just a sessional lecturer. I'm not a full-time lecturer there. But in my course outline, there's a section that talks about anti-oppressive language and pronouns, right? So like, let's find a way, and I say in the beginning of the course, let's find a way to keep each other accountable, but also to have a learning space. Like, give me space to make mistakes, and let's learn together, right? And so I can apologize and we can move forward. However, I do want to say that, you know, some of my friends who are non-binary, they often say that after you tell somebody that you're non-binary and that you use they, them pronouns, they might mess up sometimes, but in other instances, it feels like they are almost intentionally messing up. And so there is a subconscious microaggression there, right? There's a discomfort on the part of the person who is not, who is more gender conforming, to not accept, or to, it's like an unconscious attack, right? That's what a microaggression is, an unconscious attack. So for those of us who are cisgender, we really have to think about that, right? It's not that hard. I think we experience new things as a threat to our way of being, and we might need to shift our approach to that. We could also be different. It's like, right? Like, gay couples, gender non-conforming people, trans people, I promise you, we're not here to ruin straight marriages or like abuse children or whatever nonsense people think. Like, that's like,
They do,
that's
though.
that is like not our agenda. Like, our agenda is like to resist things that affect our mental health, right? Because you grow up in a place, like people will often say to me, Raheem, there's so many queer people now represented in on like Netflix television shows, and like your histories are now reflected in a lot of school curricula, and we're broadening sex education. Like, we've made so much progress. We've legalized same-sex marriage here, and over there, I know criminalization of sex has been gay sex has been struck down. So, well, there's all this progress, right? What are the outstanding issues? Is kind of the way, like, what's left on this agenda? And I would say, wow, it doesn't matter that all of those things are there. I still grew up in a world that was predominantly straight, and the messages from that world are still things that I'm dealing with because those were seeds of shame. And many of my straight female friends are struggling with the same messages they grew up with because, you know, they're in their 30s and they're like, do I want to get married? Maybe, maybe not. If I am married, do I want to have kids? And maybe, maybe not. What they're struggling with are all the messages that they got and they continue to get about what it means to be a woman, and like this duty around what it, like how to be in a relationship, and the function of a woman's body. And they're like, this is not necessarily what I want to do with myself. I'm like, yeah. And it's hard to have that conversation because this world didn't create space for that. So these are all things that sound like they're about being conservative or progressive, but actually they're about opening up ways to be in the world that are not dictated by one dominant culture.
Exactly.
And recognizing that when conversations and ways of being are dominated by one culture or one dominant group, there's a lot of people who feel unseen and try their whole lives to conform. And when they miss the mark or struggle with those expectations, that impacts how they see themselves in the world. And that is what mental health is, how you see yourself in the world, right? And so the experiences of marginalization are directly linked to our mental health and well-being.
Damn, I mean, growing up confining to a gender norm, specifically growing up in India, where, I mean, we are not treated well as women, to be honest. And I know what you said, everything about marginalization and how men treat us here. We know that the stares that we get because we confine to, and if we just start going on, having conversations about sexuality as females specifically, they'll just, oh yeah, that's because, they are just not safe here because they wear short clothes, or they're just not safe here because, yeah, gay men will make them feel safe because, they don't want anything. We just want to just sleep with them. The kind of conversations that people have here, and the kind of, the kind of body shaming that I grew up with as a child has still impacted me till the date that if somebody else says something about, getting fat, it'll trigger something in the back of my head and I'll be like, oh my God, I need to do more cardio, or I need to, work out even more because I don't look okay. And
And women in our
yes.
culture,
Yeah.
like aunties are so emboldened to comment on
Yes.
other people's bodies. Like it's such a, I
Yes.
think it's similar whether you live there or here.
Yes, it is similar. It is similar. Exactly. And I don't understand why.
Well,
We grew up with a lot of, they just know how to, make you feel insecure as a child. And I think that is like the worst thing that you could do to a child. Gave us so much trauma, especially as females. I'm not saying males don't have, I mean, of course they do.
no, but this is a separate thing. It's worth talking
Yeah.
about. Say more.
Exactly. And the kind of marginalization that LGBTQA and females feel, and it's a topic that, I think like we can shift the narrative a little bit, but still I feel whatever that you said about marginalization and how it impacted mental health, specifically for females and for LGBTQA members, especially in a brown community. I
I
mean,
think
nobody should go through that.
totally. So you bring up a very good point, and I think it's a dynamic that's common and worth highlighting. And that is like what is often termed lateral violence, right? Is that a term you use or you've heard?
No, I have not heard
No,
lateral.
okay. So lateral being like on the same wavelength, right? So within a community, right? So the idea is that we're socialized to fit into a community where there's a larger society that has a hierarchy of values, right? And so when women learn about how to be in the world from a perspective of patriarchy, they learn ways to conform, right? And so when they learn ways to conform, they then impose those ideas on other women. So that's the lateral violence or within a community. And one of the things patriarchy inspires is competition among women and judgment among women. In the same way, I can say for gay men, the power of dominant heterosexual masculinity leaves gay men to regulate, monitor, and comment on each other's level of masculinity. So we experience a lot of femme phobia, for example. We'll say, oh, this person's too feminine. I don't want to be with them.
Yeah.
or he's not man enough, when really there should be no one way to be a man. Like I think it's specifically a beautiful thing to be a femme gay man. I think that's a lovely thing, you know? Like that should be celebrated, not diminished. And
Exactly.
for and with women, I see this a lot. You know, my friend Mohini, who's Bengali, I met her when we worked at ASAP together, and then she ASAP was the Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention, and
Right,
for, you know,
yeah.
the last 15 years we've been best friends. She often will say, you know, women have been taught to be the gatekeepers of patriarchy in so many ways. And so moms and aunties everywhere who have carried with them the trauma of their bodies being regulated, of diet culture, of slut shaming and competition with other women to please men or get the attention of men, or see attention and approval of men as proximity to power, you know, they enforce a lot of lateral violence on other women, and intergenerationally that gets passed down
Right.
to their daughters and sons. You know, their sons can do no wrong, and their daughters get all the brunt of all of the criticism. And this is a really damage, it's such a damaging thing on a person's psyche,
Yeah, it is.
right?
Yes.
Because then, like for a lot of brown men, their toxicity goes unchallenged, or there's endless forgiveness and love for it without a firm, hard line. And women are punished for not being nurturing enough, wearing the wrong things, not being married, not producing children, saying the wrong thing. You know, like in my, like so many brown women I see here, and I imagine it's similar in India. It's like later in their 30s where they say, you know what? I might be like, I'm an introvert, I'm on the autism spectrum, or I'm neurodivergent. I can't do all of these things that other people expect me to, but my whole life I've had to perform. I've had to like learn to mask myself and perform in these ways because that's what brown women have to do.
Yeah.
We just expect it. I'm like, oh,
And
that's so
it's talked about
awful.
as, you know, it's talked as hiding behind, you know, as a sacrificing thing that, you know, you are a woman, so you have to sacrifice a lot for your family, put your career needs aside, don't talk about issues that you face, and be the perfectionist. Like a perfect, you can have a shitty dad, but you can't have a shitty mom in brown culture. You
Yes.
absolutely cannot.
Wanted to mention, you know, or I think the note that I want to end on is bringing it back to mental health, recognizing that, you know, for some people, a safe space to talk about gender and sexuality can feel like an added bonus, like it can feel helpful. But for so it can feel like, you know, it's like slightly more helpful, but for so many people it can be dire. You know, like if I don't have this affirming space, I could feel so isolated that I might have feelings and thoughts of self-harm and suicide, you know, and many people often fear being like of faith and queer and like what that'll mean, you know, like I'll be punished, my church will kick me out, I'll be excommunicated. Other people really worry, like my family will disown me. And each of these things does happen. And, you know, I've met a number of people who are youth that are homeless because they came out or were outed. So, you know, on the one hand, we can think about like discussion and dialogue, and how that shifts the culture and society to create a more affirming space in general. But then we also have to talk about like the urgency and immediate need, the dire need for many other people, right? Like they can't wait any longer because literally their lives are at stake. You know, so it's important to think about the theoretical shifts that can happen with large scale attitudes in society, but then also We have to think about the urgency of conversation because it affects people's mental health and their well-being.
It does, exactly. Our whole life, I feel like, from the moment we are born, we are just trying to figure out who we are. A little bit of that, I mean, we can't figure out who we are
Yes.
exactly by confining to a
Yes.
particular, you know,
Yes.
gender, but it still gives sense of belonging. It still gives sense of purpose to work towards something, to at least know who you are. And that is how I feel like, you know, our mental health is related to how we identify as openly. I think having discussions and creating safe spaces in environments such as colleges
Yes.
or environments such as schools can
Yes.
actually go a long way than
Yes.
making sure, you know, people get to know all of their things from social media, which is, I don't think, a very good
It's not so
platform.
great. I think we also have to recognize, like people who are going to like university and get a university education that are the first generation in their family to do that, there's a unique schism there. Like if your parents also went to university, they'll appreciate what that campus culture can provide you. If they don't know, if they don't have that experience, they assume you're going to school to be able to get a better job that will help the entire family and will help your family in generations to come. It's part of legacy making in a way. However, what they don't recognize is, oh, your kid goes to, away to school and they don't just become an engineer or a scientist or a biologist or whatever. Their mind opens up to different ways of thinking and being, and they start questioning all kinds of norms, right? And so when you become more, let's say you go to university and you have a lot of great discussions about gender and sexuality, you meet a community that supports you. If you go back to your hometown or to your family of origin, even that affirming self-discovery can then feel isolating, right?
That
So the
is
different
true.
kind of isolation, because you're like, oh, now my parents and this community don't get it, where I originated.
That is true, specifically in I think brown culture. I mean, you and I
Yes.
will relate a lot to it. We are just supposed to carry the burdens of patriarchy, no matter what gender you are,
Yes.
right? And the idea of, you know, I mean, this is something that I, as a female, hear a lot, that your entire honor depends on, you know, your vagina. Basically, if you love somebody
Yeah.
in your vagina, your honor
Yeah.
is gone, and so is
Yeah.
your community. I didn't ask you to put honor in my vagina. Nobody did. Why
Yeah.
am I supposed to hear such things? Especially, and it goes for, you know, gay men as well.
Yeah, it's so
It goes
silly.
for all the minority people who cannot.
Yes.
I don't understand why toxic masculinity does this, and it's appreciated so much, even in 21st century till now, where we actually are scared. We actually are scared to make choices to go towards who we are as people, to identify
Yeah.
as a particular gender, which is something that drives me insane because everybody should have choices,
Agreed.
and this is crazy. So yeah, I feel like we've covered like almost everything that I wanted to ask Rahim. Any, you know, concluding remarks that you have for people who are just scared of coming out right now, who feel like, you know, in a brown community, maybe it's not appreciated. I think we covered it in general,
Yeah,
but still,
I would say at this particular time and place, if you're looking to see yourself represented and reflected in the larger world as a South Asian person, social media can provide that. Right? So use those resources. There was a time when people thought they were the first ones coming out in their community because they couldn't connect with that history. It's not documented in the same way as other histories, but that's less true now because of social media, right? I think if you need mental health support because you're depressed, anxious, suicidal, seeking out formal support is useful. I think most university campuses should have mental health supports.
Yeah.
And even if they don't advertise it, I imagine that their counselors are LGBTQ affirming. If they're really not, I would look into some mental health apps, you know, to see. And I don't think apps can replace therapy or human connection,
Yeah.
but I think there's a spectrum of mental health and hygiene, which is like, you know, like the fine tune-ups, the
Yes.
things that you do to stay well, like the way you
Yes.
take supplements, you know? So like
Yeah.
maybe an app can help in that way. But if you need something more intensive, I think please seek it out. And I can't underscore the value of affirming friends and community, you
Yeah.
know, a community of, it doesn't have to be just LGBTQ people. It could also be allies. But community is so important, right? I think as South Asian people, we know that our whole
Yeah.
lives revolve around community. So
Gossips.
we already have that skill. Build a community. Yeah, the
Yeah.
gossip will come later, but build a community, right?
Yeah.
Because that we feel held in a community.
We
We have a
do.
place in a belong a sense of belonging in a
Belonging.
community. So we have to create a community that works for us.
Perfect. Answers almost everything that my friends and I had doubts about LGBTQ, and it was so amazing to have you, Rahim. Thank you so much again for coming and speaking about these issues. Thank you so much for connecting. And I hope like we get to have more open discussions later on, with you if my friends have some
Yes.
doubts or anything. I probably will do another episode with you. Let's see.
That sounds amazing. Take good care.
You too. Bye.
Striving to know who we are is what keeps us going. A big, big, big thank you to Rahim for coming onto our show and speaking about these issues. I hope this conversation brings in the change that we both expected and that people keep thriving to know who they are and do not shy away from it. I would like to end this episode with the lines of John Keating, which state, "Just when you think you know something, you have to look at it in another way. Even though it may seem silly or wrong, you must try. Don't just consider what author thinks, consider what you think. You must strive to find your own voice, because the longer you wait to begin, the less likely you are to find it all. Most men lead life of quiet desperation. Don't be resigned to that. Break out, dare to strike out, and find a new ground. And with this, I wish you all a very happy 2024. Stay warm, stay safe, and remember to keep striving."